Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1375. Team Trump takes the field, part one. This is being recorded on March 23rd of the year 2025. There have been a number of different things going on, including a public transit strike that has made things inconvenient. So the relative backlog or log jam in recordings is due to that, but they are forthcoming. Speaking of forthcoming, the new 64-gigabyte flash drive is now ready with all of my life's work, both printed and recorded, plus all of the brilliant comments by Parafractal, our contributing editor, and a mini library of old anti-fascist books on easy-to-download PDF files. The old 32-gigabyte flash drive just does not have enough room on it, and the programs in this series, I think, will exemplify why it is so important for people who listen to this program to get that flash drive so that they can preserve a record of what happened for themselves. I get no money whatsoever from that, and it's been quite remarkable for me personally to see things unfolding quite rapidly in a manner that I had foreseen for some time. And, once upon a time when I was talking about this country going fascist, people would treat me like I have a B blank 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 going out of my head. And now, not so much. Now more people are willing to face the obvious, although whether it turns out to be enough, I am skeptical. But sadly, things have taken the turn that I foresaw decades ago, and I think that if our civilization is ever to be rebuilt, that 64-gigabyte flash drive will perhaps play a role in that, in that it chronicles the disintegration of our civilization, the forces that led to that disintegration, and what is taking place, what will be taking place. And again, I'm not optimistic in the least, but I've seen this coming for a long time, and there could be no better way of ensuring that there will be something of a future for the civilization that we have come to accept as a commonality than getting that flash drive. Now, we're going to begin this series by picking by excerpting from the record program 1356. This was edited on November, in early November of last year, 2024. And we're going to listen to a roughly 6-minute, excerpt of the introduction to For the Record program number, 1356. In addition to my own voice, you'll also hear the voice of my, co-host, Monty, as well. On Saturday, September 7th, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump predicted that his plan to deport 15 to 20 million people currently living in the U.S. would be, quote, bloody, unquote. He also promised to prosecute his political opponents, including, he wrote, lawyers, political operatives, donors, illegal voters, and election officials. Retired chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley told journalist Bob Woodward that Trump is, quote, a fascist to the core, the most dangerous person to this country, unquote. On October 14th, Trump told Fox News Channel host Maria Bartiromo that he thought enemies within the U.S. were more dangerous than foreign adversaries, and that he thought the military should stop those, quote, radical left lunatics, unquote, on Election Day. Since then, he has been talking a lot about, quote, the enemy from within, unquote, specifically naming Representative Adam Schiff and former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, both Democrats from California, as, quote, bad people, unquote. Schiff was the chair of the House Intelligence Committee that broke the 2019 story of Trump's attempt to extort Volodymyr Zelensky that led to Trump's first impeachment. Trump's references to, quote, the enemy from within, unquote, have become so frequent that former White House press secretary turned political analyst Jen Psaki, P-S-A-K-I, has called them his closing argument for the 2024 election. And she warned that his construction of those who oppose him as, quote, enemies, unquote, might sweep in virtually anyone he feels is a threat. In a searing article today, political scientist Rachel Bitecover, B-I-T-E-C-O-F-E-R of The Cycle, explained exactly what that means in the piece titled, quote, What Really Happens If Trump Wins, unquote. Bitecover outlined Adolf Hitler's January 30th, 1933 oath of office, in which he promised Germans he would uphold the Constitution and the 3 months he took to dismantle that Constitution. By March, she notes, the concentration camp Dachau was open. Its first prisoners were not Jews, but rather Hitler's prominent political opponents. By April, Jews had been purged from the civil service, and the opposition political parties were illegal. By May, labor unions were banned, and students were burning banned books. Within the year, that's 1933, public criticism of Hitler and the Nazis was illegal, and denouncing violators paid well for those who did it. Why don't you continue from there, Moppy?
Of course. Bitecover writes that Trump had promised mass deportations, quote, that he cannot deliver unless he violates both the Constitution and the federal law, end quote. To enable that policy, Trump will need to dismantle the merit-based civil service and put into office those loyal to him rather than the Constitution. Then he will purge his political opponents. For once those who would stand against him are purged, Trump can act as he wishes against immigrants, for example, and others. 90 years ago, as American reporter Dorothy Thompson ate her breakfast at her hotel in Berlin on 25 August 1934, a young man from Hitler's secret police, the Gestapo, quote, politely handed me a letter and requested a signed receipt, end quote. She thought nothing of it, she said. Quote, but what a surprise was in store for me. End quote. The letter informed her that, quote, in light of your numerous anti-German publications, she was being expelled from Germany. She was the first American journalist to be expelled from Nazi Germany, and that expulsion was no small thing. Thompson had moved to London in 1920 to become a foreign correspondent and began to spend time in Berlin. In 1924, she moved to the city to head the Central European Bureau for the New York Evening Post and the Philadelphia Public Ledger. From there, she reported on the rise of Adolf Hitler. She left her Berlin post in 1928 to marry novelist Sinclair Lewis, and the two settled in Vermont. When the couple traveled to Sweden in 1930 for Lewis to accept the Nobel Prize in Literature, Thompson visited Germany, where she saw the growing strength of the fascists and the apparent inability of the Nazis' opponents to come together and stand against them. She continued to visit the country in the following years, reporting on the rise of fascism there and elsewhere. In 1931, Thompson interviewed Hitler and declared that rather than, quote, the future dictator of Germany, end quote, she had expected to meet, he was a man of, quote, startling insignificance, end quote. She asked him if he would, quote, abolish the Constitution of the German Republic, end quote. He answered, I will get into power legally, end quote, and once in power, abolish the Parliament and the Constitution, end quote, found an authority state from the lowest cell to the highest instance. Everywhere there will be responsibility and authority above, discipline and obedience below, end quote. She did not believe he could succeed. Imagine a would-be dictator setting out to persuade a sovereign people to vote away their rights, she wrote in an apparent astonishment.
That again from For the Record program number 1356 from early November of 2024. And, it's, interesting to see that, the program that Hitler basically laid out to Dorothy Thompson is not at all unlike what we are now seeing in the society as a whole. And by the way, speaking of Donald Trump and Adolf Hitler, again, Hitler moved very, very quickly. There is another interesting similarity between the two, a parallel between their arcs. Hitler had to scramble quite a bit. He was not a socialist or a communist. He was an undercover intelligence officer for the political department of the Reichswehr under General von Lossow. And he was at all times acting as an operative, a spook, a German army military intelligence operative. And he was at no point, I don't know if we're going to have time to get into it in this program, in this series, because there are many things coming from the past and looking to the future. But I think in order to set forth in a comprehensible fashion what's going on, I think some of these things maybe will need to be repeated. An interesting article from the Atlantic magazine from Friday, March 21st of 2025, What the Press Got Wrong About Hitler, by Timothy Ryback, R-Y-B-A-C-K, and talking about Adolf Hitler. See if this reminds you of someone. Hitler acquired German citizenship on Friday, February 26th of 1932. The following day, he announced his candidacy for president, setting the stage for a battle with Paul von Hindenburg, the 84-year-old field marshal and incumbent German president. One campaign poster showed Hindenburg as Atlas, bearing the world on his shoulders, alongside a diminutive caricature of Hitler jumping up and down in his brown shirt and screaming, "Ich bin noch viel stärker, I am so much stronger." In April, Hindenburg crushed Hitler by 6 million votes. Hitler had his chief legal counsel, Hans Frank, go to court to have the election results overturned, claiming that there had been irregularities by state officials and that Hitler had been unfairly disadvantaged by not being permitted to speak on the radio. The presiding judge chided Frank for wasting the court's time and dismissed the case, observing that 6 million votes was too large a margin for any of Hitler's claims to have made a difference. Something to think about, too, on the heels of that excerpt from For the Record Program 1356. There is one of the truly epical events of my lifetime and the lifetimes of many people was the pandemic that, of course, it took place. It is still ongoing. And something that I think will illustrate the importance of studying the past and also the importance of assessing the present in terms of the past and in terms of new formulations about what may be going on in the present as affected by the past. In 2020 and 2021, actually going into 2022, I did three overlapping series on the pandemic. One was called BioPsy Apocalypse Now, morphing directly into the Oswald Institute of Virology, and that in turn morphed into Pandemics Incorporated. That series took me roughly 2 years, those series, actually more like 2.5 years or so to put together. And they are extremely important. I have collated much of the material that the material that I've put into the archives about the pandemic. And I think it will be much easier for people to read about condensed those into articles for my Patreon platform. It is an ongoing study in realization about what's going on. And for the record, 1129, but in the spring, in May of 2020, I accessed an article from Politico, the Politico blog of May 5th of 2020. It's by Quimp, Q-U-I-N-P, Forgy, F-O-R-G-E-Y, and it's titled Fed Study Pause 1918 Flu Pandemic to Nazi Party Gains. And the article reads, a new academic paper produced by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York concludes that deaths caused by the 1918 influenza pandemic, quote, profoundly shaped German society, unquote, in subsequent years and contributed to the strengthening of the Nazi Party. The paper, published this month and authored by New York Fed economist Christian Blickel, B-L-I-C-K-L-E, examined municipal spending levels and voter extremism in Germany from the time of the initial influenza outbreak until 1933, and shows that, quote, areas which experienced a greater relative population decline, unquote, due to the pandemic, spent, quote, less per capita on their inhabitants in the following decade, unquote. The paper also shows that influenza deaths of 1918 are correlated with an increase in the share of votes won by right-wing extremists, such as the National Socialist Workers Party, unquote, in Germany's 1932 and 1933 elections. Together, the lower spending and flu-related deaths, quote, had a strong effect on the share of votes won by extremists, specifically the extremist National Socialist Party, unquote, the Nazis, the paper posits. Quote, this result is stronger for right-wing extremists and largely non-existent for left-wing extremists, unquote. Despite becoming popularly known as the Spanish flu, the influenza pandemic likely originated in the United States at a Kansas military base, eventually infecting about one-third of the global population and killing at least 50 million people worldwide, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Germany experienced roughly 287,000 influenza deaths between 1918 and 1920, Blickel writes. The paper's findings are likely due to, quote, changes in societal preferences, unquote, following the 1918 outbreak, Blickel argues, suggesting the influenza pandemic's, quote, disproportionate toll on young people may have, quote, spurred resentment of foreigners among the survivors, unquote, and driven voters to parties, quote, whose platform matched such sentiments, unquote. The conclusions come amid fears that the current coronavirus pandemic will shake up international politics and spur extremism around the world as officials and public health experts look to previous outbreaks for guidance on how to navigate the months and years to come. One more time, the last paragraph of this article. The conclusions, again, that the 1918 influenza pandemic have a lot to do with the rise of Hitler. The conclusions come amid fears that the current coronavirus pandemic will shake up international politics and spur extremism around the world as officials and public health experts look to previous outbreaks for guidance on how to navigate the months and years to come. And that's something to keep in mind. Again, in that long, in those long overlapping series, again, the Oswald, BioSap Apocalypse Now, the Oswald Institute of Virology and Pandemics Incorporated, I set forth a very compelling body of information that, in fact, COVID does come from a laboratory. It didn't leak, and the laboratory wasn't in China. It comes from the U.S. It's the North Woods virus, but it's even more than that. Given that at the end of World War II, we took in the creme de la creme of the Third Reich's national security establishment, we did the same thing with the Japanese biological warfare program at Unit 731 in Manchuria. And I wonder to what extent the pandemic was intended to produce the following dynamic. This is from the Atlantic Magazine from February 18th of 2025. How COVID pushed a generation of young people to the right. It's by Derek Thompson, T-H-O-M-P-S-O-N, and it reads, for decades, America's young voters have been deeply and famously progressive. In 2008, a youth quake sent Barack Obama to the White House. In 2016, voters ages 18 to 29 voted for Hillary Clinton by 18 points. In 2020, they voted for Joe Biden by 24 points. In 2024, Donald Trump closed most of the gap, losing voters under 30 by a 51 to 47 margin. In one recent CBS poll, Americans under 30 weren't just evenly split between the parties, they were even more pro-Trump than boomers over 65. Precisely polling teens and 20-somethings is a fraught business. Some surveys suggest that Trump's advantage among young people might already be fading. But young people's apparent rightward is not an American-only trend. Quote, far-right parties are surging across Europe, unquote, and young voters are buying in, unquote. The journalist Hamme, H-A-M-M-E, Coquelaire, C-O-K-E-L-A-E-R-E, wrote for Politico last year. In France, Germany, Finland, and beyond, young voters are swinging their support toward anti-establishment far-right parties, quote, in numbers equal to and even exceeding older voters, unquote. In Germany, a 2024 survey of 2,000 people showed that young people have adopted a relatively new, gloomy outlook, unquote, on the future. No surprise, then, that the far-right Alternative für Deutschland has become the most popular party among Germans under 30. Like most interesting phenomena, this one even has a German name, Rechtsruck, or rightwardship, that's capital R-E-C-H-S-T-R-U-C-K. The article continues, what's driving this global Rechtsruck? It's hard to say for sure. Maybe the entire world is casting a protest vote after several years of inflation. Last year was the largest wipeout for political incumbents in the developed world since the end of the Second World War. One level deeper, it wasn't inflation on its own, but rather the combination of weak real economic growth and record immigration that tilled the soil for far-right upstarts, who could criticize progressive governments on both sides of the Atlantic for their failure to look out for their own citizens first. There was another potential driver of the global right turn, the pandemic. Pandemics might not initially seem to cash out in any particular political direction. After all, in the spring of 2020, one possible implication of the pandemic seemed to be that it would unite people behind a vision of collective sacrifice, or at least collective appreciation for health professionals or for the effect of vaccines to reduce severe illnesses among adults. But political science suggests that pandemics are more likely to reduce rather than build trust in scientific authorities. One cross-country analysis published by the Systemic Risk Center of the London School of Economics found that people who experience epidemics between the ages of 18 and 25 have less confidence in their scientific and political leadership. This loss of trust persists for years, even decades, in part because political ideology tends to solidify in a person's 20s. The paper certainly matches the survey evidence of young Americans. Young people who cast their first ballot in 2024 were, quote, more jaded than ever about the state of American leadership, unquote, according to the Harvard Political Review. A 2024 analysis of Americans under 30 found the, quote, lowest levels of confidence in most public institutions since the survey began, unquote. In the past decade alone, young Americans' trust in the president has declined by 60%, while their trust in the Supreme Court, Wall Street, and Congress has declined by more than 30%. Another way that COVID may have accelerated young people's Rechtsruck in America and around the world was by dramatically reducing their physical world socializing. That led, in turn, to large increases in social media time that boys and girls spent alone. the Norwegian researcher Ruben B. Matheson, capital M-A-T-H-I-S-E-N, has written that, quote, social media creates separate online spheres for men and women, unquote. By creating gender-blended hangouts in basements and restaurants for gender-segregated online spaces, young men's politics became more distinctly pro-male and, more to the point, anti-feminist, according to Matheson. Norwegian boys are more and more drawn to right-wing politics, a phenomenon, quote, driven in large part by a new wave of politically potent anti-feminism, unquote, he wrote. Again, quoting, although Matheson focused on Nordic youth, he noted that his research built on a body of surveyed literature showing that, quote, the ideological distance between young men and women has accelerated across several countries. By the way, we spoke about and we will be coming back to matters in South Korea. That's one of the countries where there's a huge divide between young men and young women. Young men trending to the right, young women looking for a more progressive orientation. Continuing with the article. These changes may not be brutal. Actually, let me begin with the last sentence again. Although Matheson focused on Nordic youth, he noted that his research built on a body of surveyed literature showing that, quote, the ideological distance between young men and women has accelerated across several countries, unquote. These changes may not be durable, but many people's political preferences solidify when they're in their teens and 20s. So do other tastes and behaviors, such as musical preferences and even spending habits. Most famously, so-called depression babies who grew up in the 1930s saved more as adults, and there was some evidence that corporate managers born in the 30s were unusually disinclined to take on loans. One more time. Most famously, so-called depression babies who grew up in the 1930s saved more as adults, and there was some evidence that corporate managers born in the 1930s were unusually disinclined to take on loans. Perhaps the 18 to 25-year-old cohort whose youth were thrown into upheaval by COVID will adopt a set of socio-political assumptions that form a new sort of ideology that doesn't quite have a name yet. The Atlantic's Anne Applebaum has written, many emerging European populist parties now blend vaccine skepticism, quote, folk magic, unquote, mysticism, and deep anti-immigrant immigration sentiment. Spiritual leaders are becoming political, and political actors have veered into the occult, she wrote. New ideologies are messy to describe and messier still to name, but in a few years, what we've grown accustomed to calling Generation Z may reveal itself to contain a subgroup, Generation C, COVID-affected, and for now, strikingly conservative. For this microgeneration of young people in the U.S. and throughout the West, social media has served as a crucible where several trends have fused together, declining trust in political and scientific authorities, anger about the excesses of feminism and social justice, and a preference for rightward politics. Yes, indeed, that is a very interesting thing indeed. And now, looking at that assessment from that Atlantic article, that COVID may actually be a driver of a shift to the right globally, and the article itself also posits that the shift is one that what I'm wondering is this. Was this intended? Was this rightward shift intended? I suspect that it was. And I think that the people who did this knew full well what it was that they were doing. And we're going to take a look. You know, I've said for quite some time that on November 22nd, 1963, the U.S. experienced a coup d'etat, and in addition to that, two wars both thought to have ended long before ended on that day. One of those was World War II, and it ended with an opposite result from that that the history books have recorded, namely the Axis won. And the other war that ended was the war between the states, or the Civil War, as it's known in the North, and it ended with the South winning. And that is basically what we are witnessing now. It's interesting to me personally. You know, I've been warning about what was coming for, well, the better part of half a century now. Again, I'm in my 46th year on the air, and I've been warning people about the onset of fascism in his something that I've read on the air many times, and that is the text of Jack Ruby's last letter smuggled out of prison on January 31st of 1966, in which he warned that, quote, Nazis were in charge of this country right now, and that's who killed the president. Well, again, that sounds like a crazy thing to people, but maybe perhaps not so crazy. Another thing I've pointed out is that this country is beset by two kinds of Nazis. There are the Nazis Nazis, whom Ruby said were in control of this country in 1966, and he was right. And then there are the NOP-SEES Nazis, the ones who just won't see what is going on. I was very interested to see the reaction of people to Elon Musk's salute at the inauguration. People are defenders of Trump and Elon Musk are claiming, oh, it was a Roman salute. It was a Nazi salute, basically. The importance of studying the past is one of the things that comes to fore. What we're going to do before we proceed with this discussion, I don't know how much time we're going to have left, but we're going to listen to a portion of a miscellaneous archive show called South Africa, the Third Reich, and the Bomb. Now, this was recorded 40 years ago. This was recorded on May 12th of 1985. This is about the apartheid South Africa government. And bear in mind that in 1985, roughly 40 years ago, the apartheid South Africa government was still in power. We're going to listen to, again, a miscellaneous archive show, and we're going to listen to a discussion of something that most people just, through no fault of their own, are not aware of, and that is the profound links between the Bruderbon, or Brotherhood, as it's called in English, and the Third Reich and the apartheid government in South Africa. In addition to my own voice, you're also going to hear the voice of my brilliant and charming former co-host, Nip Tuck.
All right, in order to understand the South African government, we're going to step back and review some material that a long time and dedicated listeners to One Step Beyond have heard before. And for those of you who have heard this, patience, we're going to introduce some new material during the second prepared portion of the broadcast. But for the benefit of the relatively recent listeners or people who are just sort of tuning in or signing on here, we're going to go ahead and review a little bit about the origins of the South African government. Now, the key organization that you want to know about in with regard to South African political and cultural life is called the Bruderbond, Broederbond, Bruderbond. Basically, in Afrikaans, that means the Brotherhood. Now, that is a small but very, very powerful fascist organization which dominates the National Party of South Africa. Now, the National Party is the dominant political party of South Africa. The National Party controls all of South African political life. The Bruderbond totally dominates the National Party. In addition, the Bruderbond has infiltrated the educational system, the cultural life of the nation in every respect, so it's much more than just the government. The Bruderbond essentially controls the entire fabric of South African society. Now, the Bruderbond basically is an explicit fascist organization. They are Afrikaner nationalists. In other words, they are explicit racists who feel that the Afrikaner peoples, those of Afrikaner extraction in South Africa, are basically gifted and they view the Afrikaners as having a God-given right to dominate all of the other ethnic groups in South Africa. Now, the key element in the formation of the Bruderbund concerned its reorganization along the lines of the German Nazi Party, the NSDAP. Now, this happened prior to, just before World War II, and interestingly enough, the Bruderbund was reorganized along the lines of the German Nazi Party in conjunction with representatives from the Third Reich, with German spies, basically, or in conjunction with them. The main name that we want to be knowing about with regard to the South African end of this connection is a guy named D.F. Malan, last name M-A-L-A-N. Malan was not only the first Prime Minister of South Africa, but was head of basically was the author of something called the Wartime Draft Constitution. This basically was an Afrikaner constitution drawn up by the Bruderbund and other Afrikaner nationalist groups, and this wartime draft constitution drawn up by D.F. Malan served as the basis for the South African government as set up in 1948. Now, D.F. Malan was the fellow who established the working relationship between the Bruderbund and representatives of the Third Reich. Now, this relationship, this working relationship between the Bruderbund and Third Reich representatives, specifically a man named von Montmartin, M-O-N-T-M-A-R-T-I-N, was to result, as I indicated, in the reorganization of the Bruderbund along the lines of the organizational structure of the German Nazi Party, and that began a close working relationship between the German Nazi Party and the Bruderbund. Now, during World War II, the territory now called South Africa, the independent nation of South Africa, was a British colony. The Afrikaners tended to side with the Nazis against the British, and specifically the Bruderbund and many key members of it, including some men, as who, as Niptuck's going to read you in a couple of minutes, were to go on and become prime ministers of South Africa, fought or lent their efforts to the Axis cause. Now, of the relationship between the German Nazi Party and the Bruderbund, and the former's efforts in reorganizing the latter, we're going to read you from a book, or I'm going to read you from a book called The Rise of the South African Reich. The Rise of the South African Reich is authored by an exiled South African journalist named Brian Bunting, last name B-U-N-T-I-N-G. It was published in softcover by Penguin Books, and specifically as part of the Penguin African Library, and was copyrighted 1968. So now I'm going to read you a short section about the reorganization of the Bruderbund by Brian Bunting from The Rise of the South African Reich. In an article in the Sunday Times on the 8th of March, 1964, Mrs. Janie Malherbe, M-A-L-H-E-R-B-E, wife of South Africa's wartime director of military intelligence and herself a captain in military intelligence during the war, described the forces which had been at work in the Bruderbund during the 30s. This terrifying, octopus-like grip on the South African way of life was made possible by reorganizing the Bruderbund on the pattern of Hitler's highly successful Nazi state, complete with Führer, Gauleiters, group and cell leaders, spread in a sinister network over the whole of South Africa. This was initially planned by a high-ranking nationalist and two Stellenbosch students who were sent to Germany at Nazi expense to study the Nazi cell system. The man who planned this, in consultation with the then-nationalist leader Dr. Malan, was Graf von Durkheim Montmartin, M-O-N-T-M-A-R-T-I-N. The Nazi government had sent Montmartin to South Africa in 1934, ostensibly to attend an educational conference, but in reality, as was subsequently discovered from captured German documents, to consult secretly with Bruderbund leaders in order to foment a plan which would ensure that South Africa would side with Germany in the World War which Hitler was then already engineering. Mrs. Malherbe writes, "The immediate result of this visit was the reorganization of the nationalist Bruderbund on the Nazi system, the main difference being that where Hitler reinvoked the rights of the German pagan gods to promote his ideologies, the nationalists Bruderbund declared that their plan of complete domination of white South Africa and absolute subjugation of the non-whites was an implementation of South Africa's God-given destiny. This was a clever ruse, for by its means, the powerful Dutch Reformed churches could be roped in." So again, Malan, heading up the nationalist organizations, including the Bruderbund, establishes a working relationship with the Third Reich, which results in the reshaping of the Bruderbund along the lines of the German Nazi Party and an active pattern of cooperation set up between the German Nazi Party and the Bruderbund. And recall that this very same D.F. Malan draws up the wartime draft constitution, which goes on to serve as the basic model for the South African government under the National Party. This also described in The Rise of the South African Reich by Brian Bunting. "The Afrikaner Bruderbund," declared Lombard. By the way, Lombard is a pro-Afrikaner writer here, journalist. "The Afrikaner Bruderbund," declared Lombard, is born from a deep conviction that the Afrikaner nation has been planted in this country by God's hand and is destined to remain here as a nation with its own character and its own mission. As will be seen later, these aims of the Bruderbond bear a striking resemblance to the notorious draft constitution for a future South African Republic, which was drawn up by nationalist-oriented organizations during the war, and the basic principles of which have underlain the policy and actions of the Nationalist Party ever since it came to power in 1948.
Okay. Now, we're going to read a couple of more sections from another book. This book is called The Bruderbond, and it is written by Ivor Wilkins, I-V-O-R, Ivor Wilkins, and Hans Stridom, S-T-R-Y-D-O-M. This is copyright 1979, Paddington Press, distributed in the United States by Grosset and Dunlap. Okay, and again, we're going to be checking some of the early routes of the Bruderbund to power and some of the shaping and motive forces behind the Bruderbund. Okay, Wilkins and Stridom write, "The South African government today is the Bruderbund, and the Bruderbund is the government. No Afrikaner government can rule South Africa without the support of the Bruderbund. No nationalist Afrikaner can become prime minister unless he comes from the organization's select ranks." And select is right. I think by about 1977 or 78, when a lot of this information came from, there were only about 3,500, maybe a few more than that, but not less than 5,000 members in the Bruderbund. This is not a large organization like the Nazi Party got to be by the end of the war in Germany. This is a group of people who have elected to join to advance careers, not because they were forced to do it, because there were, you know, people sweeping the neighborhoods or anything. Mr. P.W. Botha, the current Prime Minister, is a member, as were his four predecessors, Dr. D.F. Malan, Advocate J.G. Stridom, spelled different than the author, S-T-R-I-J-D-O-M, Dr. H.F. Verwoerd, and Mr. John Voerster. Every member, except two, of the Botha cabinet is a Bruderbonder. From this pinnacle of executive control over South Africa's affairs, the organization's 12,000 members, okay, my mistake, permeate every aspect of the Republic's life. Through its network of more than 800 cells in the villages and cities of South Africa, the organization has infiltrated members into town and city councils, school boards, agricultural unions, the state-controlled radio and television networks, industry and commerce, banks and building societies. Its membership spirals insidiously upward through the strata of South African society, into the provincial administrations, the departments of education, planning, roads and works, the hospital services, universities, the quasi-state corporations, the civil service, the national party caucuses, working through the administrators of the provinces, through parliament and the seat of government, until it finally reaches its apex in the office of the Prime Minister. And, as mentioned, the current Prime Minister, P.W. Botha, is himself a member of the Bruderbond, as well as all but two members of his cabinet at the time of the writing of this book.
And remember that all of his predecessors, including Malan, were also Bruderbond members.
That's right. Now, skipping back again, this is Dr. Malarab, whose wife's writing Dave was reading from a little earlier. And they're talking again about the time, about World War II, and the relationship between South Africa and Britain and Germany, etc. Says Dr. Malarab goes on, quote, "With South Africa's participation in the war, anti-British feelings flared up with renewed fervor. A number of prominent Afrikaner leaders became openly pro-Nazi and found expression of their ambitions in flamboyant organizations such as the Grey Shirts and the Osava Brandvag. The latter organization, under the leadership of Dr. Hans von Rensburg, was openly militant and opposed to General Smuts' war effort. He soon counted more members than there were in Smuts' army. Among these were a large number of teachers and even Dutch Reformed ministers. South Africa's former premier, Mr. Voerster, occupied a high position as assistant Hofkommandant. Dr. Verwoerd had strong Nazi sympathies, and his paper, The Transvaaler, was jubilant over the initial reverses of the Allied forces on land and sea. Likewise, it was filled with gloom when the Nazis started losing."
And that again from Miscellaneous Archive Show, recorded on May 12th, 1985, South Africa, the Third Reich, and the Bomb. The point being, for our present purposes, that the apartheid government of South Africa was, in effect, an extension of the German Nazi Party, or the NSDAP under Hitler. When you see Elon Musk doing what he did at the inauguration, I think his gesture will acquire a much greater degree of comprehension and historical depth, knowing what the apartheid government was all about in South Africa. By the way, Peter Thiel, another driving force in the Trump administration, also has strong connections to apartheid South Africa, and both Peter Thiel's father and Klaus Schwab, who went to work for the Swiss firm Escher Weiss that had employed his father and helped build components for the Third Reich's atomic bomb. And Klaus Schwab then helped to build components for the apartheid South Africa's atomic bomb project. And Peter Thiel's father also worked on that. But we'll talk about that in future programs. But again, when Elon Musk gives a gesture like that, it's pretty unequivocal. But again, this country is beset by two kinds of Nazis, M-A-Z-I-S and N-O-T-S-E-E-S. And watching people say, oh, no, that wasn't a Nazi. One person I know said he was too stupid or that he was too crazy. He's neither. He's not too stupid and he's not too crazy. What he does have is he has a whole lot of money and he'll threaten lawsuits with people against people who don't do what he wants. An article from Yahoo News and originally from the Daily Beast by Lee Kimmins, K-I-M-M-I-N-S, from Friday, January 10th of 2025. Elon Musk and far-right German leader push wild Hitler theory. And Elon Musk and a German far-right leader appeared to come to a truly bizarre agreement during a live-streamed X-Chat Thursday. Adolf Hitler was a communist. Well, isn't that special? And both, by the way, both Musk and Alice Weidel, the last name capital W-E-I-B-E-L of the Alternativa for Deutschland, were in agreement that Adolf Hitler was a some sort of communist or socialist. That is what really quite interesting indeed. Not like any socialist that I can think of off the top of my head. What we're going to do, we're going to continue with the discussion of, you know, the shaping of young people by the pandemic. Did that have something to do? I believe the pandemic was deliberately created, and one can but wonder whether the global effect that we're seeing was one of the things that they had in mind. What we're going to do next is to listen to a few minutes of a miscellaneous archive show done in the late spring of 1984, and it is about the rise of the Nazi Party. And so we'll drop that in. Again, this is a miscellaneous archive show. It was also excerpted in AFA program number 10.
Now, where does Adolf Hitler fit into this whole business? Basically, Adolf Hitler, just like Ernst Röhm, was an underground, undercover, intelligence agent for the German army during this revolutionary period. Now, jumping back in time just a little bit, Hitler's first assignment as an undercover German army intelligence agent was to infiltrate the unsuccessful German revolution in the Munich area and betray it. And this he did quite effectively. Basically, he was a stool pigeon. Haydn writes about this in Der Führer as follows. When the white troops, that's the reactionary troops, when the white troops entered Munich, they went to the 19th Infantry Barracks and found a body of soldiers which an eyewitness later called a wild red rabble, unquote. Every 10th man chosen at random was stood up against the wall and shot. Only one was set aside from the very first to be spared. His position was only too clear. When the high officers of the Munich Reichswehr fled before the radical uprising, they had left this man behind to observe and report. A dangerous commission requiring courage, but ugly. A few months previous, this man had attracted the attention of his officers in a strange way. They all noticed him, one of them later recollected, because his salutes were so punctilious as to be provocative in those revolutionary months when most of the soldiers defiantly refrained from saluting at all. When the government troops stormed Munich, his comrades wanted to help defend the city. He made a speech dissuading them. His comrades had suspected him of being a spy, and during the Soviet regime he barely escaped arrest. Now he became the executioner. After May 2nd, an examining commission sent hundreds of men to the slaughterhouse wall. This man soon came to the attention of the commission, which used him as an informer. He delivered his reports in writing and later boasted of them. When he was ordered before the examining commission, wrote one of his friends, his indictments cast a merciless clarity upon the unspeakable disgrace of the military treason practiced by the Jewish dictatorship of Munich's Soviet period, unquote. By rank, this stool pigeon was a corporal. By nationality, strange to say, an Austrian. His stated profession was painter and architect. His name was Adolf Hitler.
That again, an excerpt from a miscellaneous archive show number 5. Adolf Hitler wasn't a communist. He wasn't a socialist. He wasn't a nut. He wasn't crazy. He was an undercover spook. He was an undercover German army intelligence officer working for the political department of the Reichswehr under General von Lossow. One of the things that we have spoken about in connection with the history of the Cold War, we originally discussed this in AFA program number 1 from April of 1984. We then came back to that in AFA program, or FTR program number 1228, about the beginning of the war in Ukraine. And that is the discussion of the fact that, again, Hitler was not, he was not a nut. He wasn't a crazy person. He was a spook. One of the things that we've spoken about, too, in AFA program number 1, and we've come back to it again in the series of, about the beginning of the war in Ukraine, and that is the fact that the phrase Iron Curtain, which we all think came from Winston Churchill, who gave a speech in Springfield, Missouri in 1946, it actually comes from Count Lutz Schwerin von Krosigk, who was the Third Reich's finance minister, and he dropped it into a propaganda broadcast in the late spring of 1945. And guess who was present at the inaugural? By the way, Count Lutz Schwerin von Krosigk's granddaughter is a member of the AFD, the Alternative für Deutschland. We're going to wrap things up with this article from GermanForeignPolicy.com. This is from that feeds along the right-hand side of the front page of the SpitfireList.com website. From GermanForeignPolicy.com of January 21st of 2025, the transatlantic far right. And guess who was at the inauguration? The new U.S. administration has offered the AFD and other extreme right-wing parties from around Europe a stage for their further normalization and for transatlantic networking. This is the significance of their invitation to President Donald Trump's inauguration. Of the many heads of state and governments in the European Union, only the most right-wing, Giorgia Meloni, was invited to the major event, which attracted worldwide attention. Trump's team also welcomed representatives from the Belgian Vlaams Belang, the Spanish Vox Party, the French Reconquête Party, and from outside the EU, the British Reform UK Party. The AFD was also represented in the US Capitol with two of its senior functionaries. Their presence at Trump's inauguration will effectively counteract attempts by the political establishments to ostracize them. Indeed, they will also be integrated to some extent into the network of transatlantic relations. We can see the emergence of the vague outlines of a transatlantic hard right. The Trump administration, now the driving force behind this trend, is backed by tech oligarchs such as Elon Musk. These supporters are among the richest people in the world, and some of them openly espouse anti-democratic ideologies. One of the things that we're going to be looking at in weeks to come, and that is the political philosophy that has been minted by people like Curtis Yarvin, a.k.a. Mencius Moldbug, people like J.B. Vance, people like P.P. Peel, and so forth, is something like a a high-tech version of the corporate state. But I think that it's worth keeping in mind that as novel as it might appear to be, what we're really looking at in connection with the swerving to the right, or the shift to the right globally, is a new form of fascism. And I think that one of the things to be contemplated, and that is the, again, in the series of essays that I'm working on for my Patreon platform, should simplify and clarify, I think, the information in the series that I did over about a two-year period. Again, the Oswald Institute of actually a Biopsy Apocalypse Now, morphing into the Oswald Institute of Virology. In turn, that morphs into Pandemics Incorporated. I suspect that among the intended goals of the pandemic was just exactly this kind of rightward shift. And I think the political article about the New York Fed Reserve paper linking the 1918 influenza pandemic to the rise of Hitler. By the way, the genome for the 1918 influenza pandemic virus was discovered by Pentagon scientists in 1997, and they had recreated the virus by the first few years of the century. But the extent to which the creation of COVID and its dissemination was intended to do just exactly what Christian Blickel posits the 1918 influenza epidemic did to people in Germany and elsewhere. Again, I wonder about the rightward shift that we're seeing. We're going to explore this at much greater length in weeks to come. But again, I think that with people like Count Lutz, Ferenc von Koenig, and then his granddaughter with the AFD, we are seeing the evolution of what I call the Underground Reich, which was a Third Reich that went underground. Please do get the 64-gigabyte flash drive. That's the new flash drive. We have too much information now for just 32-gigabyte flash drive. It has all of my life's work, both printed and recorded, the brilliant comments by Tara Fackel, our contributing editor, and a mini-library of old anti-fascist books on easy-to-download PDF files. And again, of the way our civilization is going, you don't want to be one of the MOT-SEES, so please, please get a hold of the flash drive. I get no money whatsoever from that. And again, I'm condensing, distilling my work on COVID into a series of articles for my Patreon platform. This concludes For the Record program number 1375, Team Trump Paints the Field, Part 1. This is being recorded on March 23rd of the year 2025 on Bay Memory. Thanks for listening.